Hello, welcome to Prime Lenses. I'm Ian. Each week, I speak with a guest about three lenses that have meant something to them on their photographic journey. And this week, my guest is Ethan Swope. Ethan is a photojournalist and documentary filmmaker based in LA. He covers local and international news for everyone from the Associated Press to Bloomberg. He's done stuff for Getty, The Telegraph. We had to rearrange this conversation because he was actually being sent on assignment to the US-Mexico border, something he discusses in the conversation. Sounds like a lot. But I came across his work through the stuff he was doing to cover the fires in LA recently. And I wanted to speak to someone who'd been close to it and could provide some perspective, because from where I'm sitting up in the Highlands, it is a world away and I can't quite believe what we're seeing. So I wanted to talk to someone who was close, talk to them about how they were capturing those images and how they thought about it. And I think you'll find that Ethan was a really thoughtful guest. He also, because this is perfect for someone who is a working press photographer, he also spoke to me from his car the entire time, out in the field, ready to go and get more images that afternoon. So I think you'll really enjoy this conversation with Ethan Swope. So you're just back today and then straight out again going to see the wildfires.
Correct. Yeah. So thankfully, like the flames, you know, it's all done. Now the story sort of turned to aftermath. And so working actually on a documentary right now. So filming the devastation. This past week I was in Juarez and Tijuana doing stories on immigration deportees.
Yeah.
So it's been quite a busy few weeks.
It's intense. I mean, I guess someone like, because looking at your back catalog, right, and looking at your biography, you're used to having to go around the world for this sort of stuff. And then suddenly something's landed in your backyard. That must be quite an unusual, different feeling when you're having to cover something that's so much closer, I guess.
Yeah, I mean, I've grown up in California my whole life, and so like, you know, growing up with the backdrop of wildfires, you know, is nothing new. But it's sort of, you know, photojournalism is all about, you know, telling stories in your community, and having a camera sort of allowed me to get access to places that I wouldn't normally be, and be able to witness stuff, and then being able to tell the stories and sharing it with the community. So I remember, you know, growing up, you know, massive wildfires, our school would be closed for days, for smoke days. And so, you know, I've always been covering fires in California, but the scale and magnitude of the ones in Los Angeles, you know, is unlike, you know, any of the fires that I've seen. You know, I arrived and, you know, immediately knew, but just the scale of the destruction was, you know, jaw dropping. So, you know, covering stories in your own community is, you know, very meaningful. And yes, I travel all over, but, you know, the fact that the story is so close, you know, it hits home.
Yeah. And now I guess it's under control. I'm really glad we're able to talk so close to it happening in a lot of ways, because one of the reasons I wanted to have this conversation was so that we could also point people to places to donate, ways that they can help if they're more local, things like that. So you can talk about it kind of closer too, because you've had all the rain. You had like 3 days of rain in the last week as well, which I guess has also brought problems with landslides and slippages like that, and changed it into a very different thing. Is that going to be the kind of the arc that's coming together in the documentary, do you think, of like, you know, showing the before and after?
Yeah, I mean, my own personal work, you know, I do a lot of work with the Associated Press of covering the fires. And so their main coverage, at least at the beginning, was, you know, the destruction, the fire, the immediacy of the news. And then the story transitioned more into the aftermath. Now I'm working on a documentary separate project. So it's more of a long-term story. And so I'm just sort of capturing the devastation, the destruction for this. Yeah. But no, the rains helped significantly. We hadn't had rain since, you know, anything measurable since, I believe, May of last year.
Wow. Yeah. That's crazy. That's, yeah. 'Cause, I mean, where I am in the Highlands of Scotland, the idea of going for seemingly more than a couple of weeks without rain is just like impossible.
Mm-hmm.
Yeah. Oh man, yeah. That's a lot. Yeah, that's, I guess now thoughts just turn to like, right, it's the huge Herculean effort to rebuild. Because I don't think, like, it's, you know, even the news cycle changes, and you've had some news, right, in the last few weeks, so there's been a lot going on. But it's important, I think, to relay to people listening, like, what the scale of this is. Like, the areas covered are vast, aren't they?
Absolutely. It's, you know, it's swaths of land. that were, you know, some very, very nice homes. But you, it's hard to say. I think the last estimate I saw was around $250 billion in destruction. But, you know, with the Eaton fire out in Altadena, that was, that burned significantly, you know, less, you know, less of the mansions. There's much more, you know, working class homes. And then you go to the Palisades and you have celebrities. And so, you know, they sort of hit different areas. But in my mind, wildfires are the great equalizer, where it doesn't matter who lives where, you know, as long as you're in the path of the fire, you know, they got damaged.
Yeah. Normally, it's really easy to say someone like, your photos are incredible. But your photos of that, it's such a difficult thing to be capturing, I imagine. But like, you really have done an amazing job of capturing like what that look like. It's frightening to look at them. I think that's the thing. It's not often you look at photographs and you go, that's actually, it's such an important story to tell, but it's frightening to look at because it's so, I don't know, what's the word? Not, familiar is not the right word, but you can really see yourself in that person. See someone in a war zone, you don't necessarily see yourself in like, you know, military gear with a gun, things like that. People don't necessarily see themselves in that. I think the thing that was so impactful and the reason I reached out to you from those images was you could immediately see yourself in the people you were capturing and the scenes that you were capturing. Like, do you, because you've been to war zones, you've traveled all over the world, was it just a case of, well, I have to pick up my camera and I have to go? And do you just sort of, how do you put yourself, I guess, in harm's way so consistently like that?
Yeah. You know, fires is a story that I'm drawn to, you know, as I had said, you know, being impacted by them growing up. It was just a story of such like immediacy and one that, you know, drew me to it both visually, but also, you know, with the orange and the flames, it is very visual, but the destruction is, you know, newsworthy. And it's often, you know, while it's beautiful, it's people are, you know, suffering the worst days of their life. And so doing it both with, you know, respect and dignity is super important to the work of a photojournalist. But as I said, you know, I've covered fires now for this is my sixth or seventh year doing it. And so, you know, I have the same training. I do a Cal Fire media training. So it's like the fire department, they put on training for them or for media. And I have the same equipment that firefighters have, so like the yellow, the Nomex, the, like the fire retardant equipment, the fire shelter, helmets, all of it. But I was looking at the forecast, and so we sort of had an indication that there was going to be some, you know, likelihood for extreme fire behavior if there was a fire to start. And so I was sort of monitoring, and then when there was a notification that a fire had broken out, you know, I was listening to the fire scanner, I was watching the live cameras, and you could see the column immediately, like, just building. And so I made my way and got there within about, like, an hour after it started. Yeah.
It's crazy stuff.
Yeah, it's funny. I graduate UCLA in June, so I'm still a student. Right. And so I'll graduate university in about 5 months. And so I was in class and I got the alert and I immediately left as soon as I could.
Yeah, that's like being Spider-Man, isn't it? You're like, I've got a place to, because if and also if you're going to be studying, presumably you're studying photography and visual, you know.
I'm studying film, cinematography.
Okay. So you do have to explain a little bit, like, I've got to go. Like, I've got to get out of here.
A little bit, so. Yes, indeed.
I imagined a photojournalism class filled with people who were learning to be photographers and going, all of them just getting up and running and picking up their gear.
Yeah, I mean, you know, it's interesting. With California, we have incredible press access where if you are a journalist, you can go behind the fire lines and the police lines as long as it's not a crime scene, as long as you're not like in the way. You're allowed to go pretty much wherever. And so, you know, unlike other states and other countries, we have remarkable access. But, you know, that comes with, you know, certain responsibilities where, sure, anybody can go. But I think to be able to not hinder the work of a firefighter, it's important to be in the same equipment and, you know, have some sort of training so that, you know, you aren't a liability because you do not want to make yourself the story.
No, of course not. No, that'd be the worst thing. Yeah. Especially in a situation like that. That's moving so rapidly and is very real and very dangerous. Well, I'm curious then to move away from, like, you know, life and death for a moment. What put a camera in your hands in the first place? Because if you're studying filmmaking, it sounds to me like you're driven by this real desire to tell stories.
It's sort of a long answer.
We love those.
In advertising, and he's in documentary film, and so I sort of grew up around that. But when I was really young, I think around 12, I wanted to be a character designer at Pixar, and so I was drawing all the time. I was watching the Pixar movies, and then I reached out to one of the character designers there. I was like, "Hey, I love your work. I'd love to meet, grab a coffee." And they're like, "Oh, come back when you're 16, and you can have like an internship or whatever it was." So I met them. But I, at that time, I had an existential crisis about the meaning of art, and I told myself I wanted to capture my reality with a camera. And so around 13, 14, I picked up a still camera and became my editor, the photo editor at my high school newspaper, and then started freelancing for our local paper, and then sort of gradually built from there. And then just, sort of pursued stories in my community. Reached out to mentors, and then I got my first assignment with the Associated Press when I was 17. They called me to photograph a wildfire. At that time, I didn't have my driver's license, and so I had my dad drive me to the fire.
That's amazing. Like you're getting a ride to like, how did your dad react to that? Like, I just want to drive to a wildfire.
I don't know. He's always been supportive. I made sure we stopped and got him the fire equipment. And I told my editor, I was like, I'm 17. And she's like, "Oh, I wish you hadn't told me that, but I'll pretend I didn't hear."
That's a proper good press story. An editor who doesn't care, a person who's going into the breach anyway, like taking someone or just doing whatever you need to do to get there. That's fantastic. And presumably it went well because it didn't put you off. And now here you are all these years later.
Correct. It was quite fortunate.
But in your own car now, at least. So that's a
In my own
plus.
car. Well, mostly. I have a couple different cars that I share with my family.
Yeah.
So it I just changed the cabin air filter after the LA fires because I thought it was going to rain, and then another fire broke out the next day.
Yeah.
So yeah,
Oh
I jinxed
man.
it.
It's clearly all you. So after that thing with the AP then, and whilst you're still studying, is it a balancing act to try and like, because you're getting requests to go places, you're getting to travel, you're going, you're in the thick of it, and then you're coming back and having to kind of pick up your studies. Like, do the university or colleges, whatever, are they cool with that, or do they expect that, or how are you juggling all those things?
It has been it's been a huge challenge trying to juggle everything, between school and what I'm passionate about. A lot of my work that I do, I've had to do on breaks between school. So, whether it's summer or winter, I would go to Ukraine or the Middle East. But now, because the fires have been, while school was happening, thankfully school went remote for a little bit, so that was okay. But now it's a little bit of catching up.
Yeah. And you say you've got 5 months left to so graduate this summer.
Yes, correct. If
Wow.
all goes to if all goes well.
Yeah. And then what's the plan? Is it to go freelance or?
We'll see. We'll see what happens. Right now, I'm happy where things are, so continuing to freelance, I'll look for, whatever opportunities are. But yeah, as long as I can continue, telling stories visually, that's what matters. Yeah. But I do a combination of commercial work and photojournalism. I think you have to in this day and age. Photojournalism itself, isn't necessarily sustainable. And there's no trust fund, waiting for me. So I enjoy the commercial work.
I did notice that in your portfolio of work in general, like there seems to be not a style or type of photography that like you haven't been able to turn your hand to from the stuff that I saw. Like everything was like infused with a very human and personal aspect, but it seemed like you were as comfortable, taking photos of people in a relatively calm sort of normal situation as you were like being out in the field. Do you think your field work has honed your eye for like, you can operate at 200 miles an hour, so now you can just also just as easily operate at 50, but you've got that kind of range, or how do you think about how that's prepared you for your other work?
Yeah, I mean, I think photojournalism is all about finding those moments and being observant with your eye and looking at the periphery of the image. There's not necessarily, it's super easy to go towards the big flashy, action, but often, some of the best moments are sort of at the edge of the frame. I do find it sometimes challenging personally, and it's an area of growth where after you've been photographing something, you know, that's at like a 12 in terms of action, you know, slow down and, you know, sort of hone in on those quiet moments. It is difficult. But photojournalism, you know, is about capturing that moment. And so I think that really is a skill that you learn once you learn. Really applies to, you know, everything you do, whether it is, say, weddings or, say, you know, documentary films. It's about reacting, you know, in the moment.
Do you still find that you shoot for pleasure for yourself, like those, or do you find that, like, you know, because there's a sense when I talk to a lot of photographers, there's a sense of like, you know, these are the cameras that are for me, and then there's, you know, when they pull a different one off the shelf, or sometimes it is just a gig, right? And they are like, no, I'm going to put this down. I don't pick this up again until I'm using it for a purpose, and that helps them get back into the mode. Like, do you still recreationally shoot? And do you use different tools for that? Or do you kind of find that, because it seems like you've been back like a matter of hours and you're back out getting stuff for either, you know, for future projects speculatively or whatever. So it seems like you're on the go, like it's in your head, but I just wondered whether it's fun or whether it's go time.
Yeah, you know, I think it really depends on what the project is. There's definitely, you know, more exciting assignments and then, you know, less exciting assignments. But, you know, trying to, you know, still have fun is, you know, and make, you know, something creative is, you know, is the challenge and is what is, you know, exciting about photojournalism. You know, if I wasn't happy with it, you know, I wouldn't be doing it. But it's, you know, I always have to remind myself that, you know, not everyone gets to do photojournalism, and being able to do it as a career is, you know, is a privilege. But in terms of like shooting up for myself, honestly, photojournalism and like the assignments I do is for fun.
Right.
Where, you know, I really enjoy being able to talk to people and being able to cover stories that matter. I grew up in where I would just go out and do street photography on my own. It was like, you know, 14 to just take the ferry into San Francisco and wander around. Whether or not that was advisable at that age is another question. I don't have as much time for just, you know, fun, you know, wanderings. But I do occasionally. In terms of kit, I don't know, it's cameras are sort of just a tool for me. You know, I definitely enjoy, you know, gear and acquiring gear, and I've spent too much money on gear.
Yes,
And
haven't we
now
all?
that I'm doing film and cinematography, the price range of equipment sort of just seems to jump astronomically, where, you know, instead of a photo camera costing, you know, $2,000 to $6,000, now you're looking at like a $100,000 camera, and you can't necessarily afford that, so you rent it on projects when you need it. But yeah, it is just another world of expense.
The film industry seemed to have either like learned that trick, or like the pricing is such that you almost always have to rent it. Like lenses, cinema lenses are astronomically expensive. You know, like the price. You think, I mean, I shoot with an M, a Leica M, and you think a Leica's lenses are expensive. Like, look at their cinema lenses, my friend. Like, holy smokes! Like, you just have to rent those things. Like, there's not really. It feels like a, I don't know, it feels like a business model to me rather than necessarily. I mean, obviously, there's a lot more glass in them. They're made to a lot more, you know, to a different standard. But do you want to get into then documentaries or features? Like, what's the kind of thing that you're, because you're in the right place for it.
I don't know whether I want to stay in LA, but I definitely want to sort of blend photojournalism and then documentary filmmaking. So sort of finding that path where I can have both clients is the dream. You know, I think a photo, you know, t a single photo for me is relatively easy to make, or, you know, the process of making a photo is relatively straightforward. But with video, there's a lot more moving pieces. You know, so there are pros and cons, but I do find that with video, there's so many more elements visually to capture, and then also for the audience, you know, you have audio, you have, you know, you can capture longer moments, whether, you know, than with just a photo, where it's just, you know, a singular moment. So pros and cons with both, but I enjoy the mediums equally.
So do you see yourself as like, do you want to like your stories and tell your stories, or do you, because also filmmaking is a lot more of a team sport than photography, isn't it? You know, the minute you want to involve either a performance of some sort, whether it's an actor or whether it's even someone just presenting on your behalf and things like that, like you need a sound person, you need, you know, probably someone with a light, you know, like it's kind of hard to travel without at least three of you.
Yeah, it definitely changes the dynamics. I really, one of the things I care about is, making sure that the person I'm photographing is comfortable and it feels intimate. And, when you have more people, it does change the dynamic. So it's sort of finding that balance. Yeah. What about you? What kind of photography do you do? And do you enjoy?
I'm sort of at a point in my life. I've got two small boys and I work from home, but I live in like the middle of nowhere in the Highlands. So it's absolutely stunningly beautiful in every direction. I can walk 2 minutes from my house and be surrounded by trees, and it's very peaceful, and you wouldn't actually necessarily know that you were near houses or other people a lot of the time. So I've kind of become, in the last 18 months since I moved, like very much a landscape and sort of trees and stuff like that. I've been doing a lot of experimentation with longer lenses, but like up a mountain where weirdly 90 millimeters is a great focal length for photograph for creating a scene. In the way that you would use, say, a 50 with a person, 90 starts to make sense in that way of you kind of like, yes, that's a scene there. Sometimes even 135. So I'm doing a lot of
Wow.
landscape and doing a lot of. Because I like to shoot with manual cameras as well, because I'm a sadist and I like to like make things harder for myself. I've got this dream of, in fact, hang on, let me grab this. It's hilarious.
Sure.
So I have a lens. This lens here, it's a manual R lens from the 90s that looks like a gun, right? And look, check this. This is the focusing trigger, right? That's how it focuses.
No way.
Yeah.
That is diabolical.
So you pull the trigger for listeners, you pull the trigger and the kind of it's like a telescope. And it was made for kind of photojournalisty type applications with the Leica R series in the 90s. And so I adapt it to my M. So it looks absurd, but it was on sale, like used, just after Christmas, and the place were desperate to get rid of it. So they were going to get rid of it. It's a 560 mil, and there's also a 400 mil, but it's basically just a telescope. It's a very simple lens. And I've got this dream that I'm going to use that to photograph the MotoGP because I love MotoGP and I love bike racing. But obviously, there's no point me. I mean, I know a couple of MotoGP photographers. There is no point trying to compete with the images they're making with the high-end Canon and Sony gear that they use. Their images are just like tack sharp and clinical, and they make these machines look amazing. And the people that do the work, like Rob, who I've had on the podcast, who shoots the MotoGP, his images are like paintings, right? They're incredible. So the fact that I'm using vintage glass and it's manually focused, and there'll be a bit of wobble, and there'll be a bit of, I think, just makes the images a bit more interesting. I got some great, I'll send you afterwards, some wildlife photos of birds in the garden, like we have a woodpecker and stuff. So I like taking unusual things and using them in a way that's maybe not quite how you'd expect to use them, and then finding images through that. But I'm not necessarily a storyteller as much as I'm at the moment. But I think that's changing over time because you kind of need that repetition, right? So you go back to places, and then it's for me, it's the act of returning that helps you to start to see what the pattern is. But that's because I'm very rarely in a situation that where the thing that's happening isn't going to kind of happen again. So the example I wrote about this week for the newsletter was going skiing with the kids. So for 4 weeks in a row, we're going up a local mountain, we're taking them skiing. The story of the day is going to be very similar for every one of those days once you get into the flow of it. So for me as a photographer, then I'm learning craft, I'm learning where to find interesting shots and compositions, but I'm also trying to capture a little bit of like their adventures when they're kids. So I'm unburdened by this being my job. I'm a tourist, is the way I tend to describe it. But that's why it's so nice to talk to people who are doing it, because their attitude, I think a lot of people who are interested in photography who buy cameras these days are picking them up because it's an aspirational, they like the idea of creating, a bit like you when they're younger, they're kind of finding the creative outlet that appeals to them, and they're picking up a camera. But it's great to talk to someone who's motivated by something else. I love talking to people who are photojournalists because you can sort of see it in their eyes. Like they're motivated by something different. Like the tool is irrelevant, Like you want to see what's out there and convey it.
That's amazing. That's such a good answer. And You know, I think being able to return, as you were saying, to the same subject over and over again is really how you build, you know, you can see a place or a person change over time, but also build that connection. And, you know, for you, whether it's skiing or, you know, the landscapes just returning, you know, that is your character. Yeah, that's great. But no, in terms of like different people's aspirations, you know, I think, you know, photography is so accessible, whether you can do it on your phone or whether you do it on you know, with a camera or however, you know, it's a great form of artistic expression, or just, you know, get out of the house. But yeah, I do see people, you know, everyone's marketing the latest and greatest equipment. I see that all the time on YouTube, and you know, I've spent countless hours watching, you know, gear reviews, especially when I was younger. But for me, you know, I've gotten to a point where I've bought the equipment that I need, and I don't baby it by any means. I don't have it with me. It's in the back, but I shoot on Canon, and my Canon R5s, they are beaten to you know, ends of the earth. You know, this is the silver. It's, you know, mostly silver now instead of black. The paint's gone. You know, I've had lenses break. I've had my, you know, 24 to 70. Last summer, I was photographing a riot, and a flying traffic cone hit my lens, knocked it apart. You know, I've had my 70 to 200 break twice. Once it rolled off a truck, and a second time I got tackled by a drunk person. So, you know, and insurance, and you know, insurance is my best friend, and you know, they hate me, but it's needed.
Yeah, no, exactly. But that's the other reason I think that's so valuable about talking to people who do this properly for a living is like the lenses you're listing there are not the ones that people on Instagram convince you are beautiful. Like nobody's on like the gram going, let me tell you about the 24 to 70. Right, like it's practically a kit lens in a lot of people's minds. But like, I'm with you. One of my favorite lenses is a Zeiss 35-28. Like, I'm a primes person rather than a zoom person because of the system I use. But it's like these, you know, your common or garden like cooking lenses. Like that's because that's what a lot of good work gets done with. And I think that's the secret thing with these with the podcast and the reason that I think I am now like custodian of a moderately successful podcast is because I pretend it's about gear, but it isn't. The idea is to try and like get people on who talk about how, yeah, it doesn't, what mattered was the fact that you were there in a situation where a drunk person could tackle you, as opposed to what was on the front of the camera, you know? What were you shooting
Sure.
then?
I was with the drunk person. It was a truck. I was in Ukraine. This was right before the war started, and it was a pagan new year called Malanka. And so people like carol for like 24 hours, and this person was dressed up in a fur bear costume, and like someone else was holding him chained. And so it was like, you know, middle of the night, and he like just charges at me in a drunken, you know, excited stupor, and you know, I go to the ground, and so does my gear. But
Oh,
you know,
man.
that happens sometimes. Yeah, I don't know. Kit for me, I don't know how, you know, in depth we want to go. You know, it sort of changes, but you know, it's also relatively, you know, simple and sort of stays the same as well.
I remember the day that I realized I probably didn't need anything else for like a good long while, and you know, unless a new type of image that I couldn't make came up, I was sort of furious. I was just like, oh, because I had to face the fact that it was not going to be about that. Like, I loved what I was using, and I was delighted and furious at the same time. Because then it's about the work. Then you have to go to work.
100%. That's sort of, you know, that's why I've, you know, one of the great pleasures of film now is it's sort of opened up a whole nother world of equipment to buy. But in terms of photography, yeah, the days of you know, scrolling Instagram for the latest equipment is sort of, you know, it's gone a little bit. But I don't know. I always want to try and, you know, break out of my comfort zone. Like for example, in the fires, I actually shot most of that on a 16 to 35. While my 24 to 70 is actually still in the shop. I need to call them about that. But you know, I'd like to. I have all the primes. I've been exploring a little bit more with that. But with photojournalism, it's all about reacting. So you have to be, you know, zooming. As you know, of course, there's a famous saying, you know, get closer, you know, move with your feet. But sometimes you can't. I actually had an editor one time. I had an internship at the San Francisco Chronicle, and they refused me to do anything wider than 24. They said use a 24 to 70 and a 70 to 200. It's like, I have a 16 to 35. I'm shooting a concert for you guys. Can we get this wide, wide view? And they're like, no. It's interesting. Different preferences for different people. It makes sense. But,
do they have a house style quite often that they sort of impose upon, or not impose, but like that they say, we want our images to look this way or lit a certain way?
With photojournalism, not in my experience. The wires, especially I do a lot of my work with Associated Press, they're happy with whatever I shoot. I would say the standard kit that most photojournalists use, at least for the wires, is going to be a 24 to 70, and a 70 to 200, two bodies, and then maybe a prime, maybe a 16 to 35, and then usually like a 400 or something like that if, you have to get something really far away. I think now the thing that they're looking for is speed. So getting files out fast. I love being able to tone my images, especially with the fires, and have that sort of creative control. But oftentimes we don't have that ability because we need the photos out on the wire. So sending straight from camera is something that we're doing a lot. So investing in new technology like a Starlink to be able to send from the field, in the fires, there's like no cell service. So being able to do that is important.
We're talking over Starlink right now. I live so rurally. That's what I rely on for my internet. When we bought the house, I was hanging out of a window holding a Starlink dish in one hand and my phone in the other, just to make sure that it worked. And it was a thank goodness moment when it actually worked and we could move here. But yeah, so are you Starlink mini-ing now that there's the new portable one?
I am, yeah. This was actually the first fire that we were using it on. So there was some little bit of troubleshooting. One of the things that we discovered was, at least for my Starlink, was the smoke was so thick that we couldn't actually get a signal through. So we'd have to like drive a little bit. So there is like some troubleshooting. But it's a great tool.
It's amazing. Yeah, no, it's amazing. I mean, I was reading and listening to The Verge actually when they covered the Starlink Mini coming out, and the guy, they seem to have a one of the founders like just seems to just live in the wild and just live on the road in Europe constantly. And yeah, it does sound crazy. You can run it off a power bank and just like get your, and presumably like compared to cell service, it's assuming cell service isn't disrupted in the first place, like it's very fast compared to that.
Yeah, it was absolutely. I mean, I had like no service on my phone, and just being able to have the Starlink on my dash and roam around, I was able to get updates on the fires and get updates on, other information, be able to communicate with editors. It's, a big game changer. So that's sort of, the latest frontier of, the technicalities of journalism is, getting stuff out fast and accurate.
I suppose speed is just like your superpower in this. Like it's everything. It's almost, I mean, there will be a creative image kind of element to it, but also it's just whoever gets there first, whoever gets the shot first, I guess, is the person who wins to some extent.
I think yes and no. Like I think my editors are sort of harping about getting there first and getting it out first. But I'll be honest with like these fires. I think we had, when it first started, I think there were 2-3 of us, and then as for the Associated Press, then like as the days went on, we had like up to like 12 or something like that. So a ton of people. But within the first couple hours, I was not able to get images out just because I was stuck at the top and the Starlink was buggy. So someone else was able to get photos, a colleague out first for the Associated Press. And so that bought me a little bit of time.
Yeah.
Having, teamwork is kind of important.
Yeah. I was going to ask actually about that. Like how, I'm assuming it isn't like a movie where everyone's competing because you're all in harm's way. And so it's kind of a different feeling on the ground, I guess. You're all kind of probably looking out for each other. And
yeah, it's, I don't know, I feel like both in Los Angeles and in San Francisco, where I'm from, there's a very good community of photojournalists where, very supportive of each other, and there isn't so much competition. We actually have, a few group chats where, we'll communicate if we think, something's about to happen or if there's like a fire. So we have a few different fire group chats. Where we share information, but like in the field, yeah, safety comes first. And so oftentimes we'll, tag team a couple cars together, and, sort of caravan that way. So of course, we want to be making unique images, but often, safety is paramount.
Yeah, this isn't photographing a wedding, like
No,
it's
but at the same time, you sort of pushes you to be a better photographer if you see, someone who's like, highly esteemed. They're making an image, you're like, oh, what are they doing? And then, you try and do something different.
yeah. I guess that's kind of it's nice to have those people around because you also mentioned earlier on finding mentors early on for like your photography. Is there a good community for you to kind of speak to and learn from? And have you been found that it's quite an open community or was it hard to get into?
It was no, I was very fortunate with like the mentors that I found. Someone, Noah Berger, he is like this Pulitzer Prize winning photojournalist. And he covers, all the wildfires for the Associated Press. And he does commercial work as well. But I reached out to him and I was like, hey, I love your work and I'd love to grab a coffee sometime. And he was, willing to do that when I was, 16. And then I know since then I've been, seeing him on fires and now we're colleagues and we work together. So it's sort of a nice like transition.
Got to find your people. There
Exactly.
can't be that many people willing to do what you're doing. Like lots of people want to take photos. They don't want to take photos in like dangerous situations. They're like, I'll do a story about a puppy show, or I'll do a story, rather than yes, I'll get on a plane here.
Yeah, I mean, I think it is. It is very much of a niche. I think finding your niche is some way to be successful and differentiate yourself in photography, where the market is so saturated. But I mean, to your point though, is when the fire started, I think, I don't know, I got a bunch of emails about people, from people asking, hey, I would love to ride along, and I'd love to, I want to do this, and unfortunately, I just, well, A, I was so busy, with the work that, I wouldn't be able to, but also. It is a little bit of a liability. So I think the best approach is, talking and first, making sure, get the training and get the equipment and then, and do it slowly, step by step. I first started doing like little controlled burns, like photographing controlled burns that the firefighters were doing for their own training and then, built up step by step.
That's nice. Presumably, you're building images as well that they can use, potentially, they can negotiate to buy some off you, like give you a bit of experience and training. You're producing images that maybe they can use as well, in terms of like, this is what our training looks like. And it presumably gives them access to stuff that they wouldn't normally get access to as well, which is a bonus.
Sorry, who would?
The
Who
fire
would get?
department. So, like, if they, because, but even, even if, so if I'm cynically like, I work in video games every day, but if someone says there's a photographer coming in, I'm like, cool, I'm going to ask them what else we could maybe fit into the shoot so we get some other, like, it's like the photographic equivalent of B-roll. Like, you never know when it might just be handy to have a photo of how one of these training sessions goes versus the real thing, because everyone sees the real thing all the time.
Totally. Yeah, I think so. I think, well, one of the things with my contract with the Associated Press is they own my copyright for the fires. And so, or the outtakes as well. And so that sort of the distribution is sort of out of my control. I get, a percentage of royalties from the sale as well as a day rate. But yeah, they'll own the copyright.
So you're just handing over like maybe some JPEGs that you've tweaked, but then the RAWs and everything just all go over there, and then they're presumably their photo desks then take it from there.
I keep all my files, and all they ask for is I'll be sending them like my selects. So, say 10, 20, 30 photos from, as the day goes on, and that's what they keep in their archive. And then I just have the other photos.
Cool. Wow. That's really cool. So when you first got asked to go and do, like, just say going to Ukraine, because you were there just before the war and then you've covered the fires and stuff, but presumably now you're on their list of like people they can send to dangerous places who comes back and it's all good, and you'll deliver as well based on your images. How do you get on that list in the first case? Does someone just ring you up and go, like, we're going here? Or did you kind of ramp up slowly on those ones as well, like the fires?
Well, I'm still trying to get on that list per se. There are a lot of people who want to do this work, and there are people who are amazing at it. I sort of freelance, and I will. I don't know. I think hopefully my goal one day is to be able to be called to go cover whatever. We'll see when and if that happens. Very fort. There are less positions now than there used to be, just with the news industry. So I sort of send myself places and then pitch stories. For example, like in Ukraine, I'd go and then and work on projects and then reach out to editors there. So, you know, we'll see. But yeah, I just flew out. I got an assignment from the Telegraph this week to go to Mexico to do a story on the deportee. So that was, you know, that was cool.
Yeah, that sounds like quite a trip. How did that trip go? Was it good?
It was good until it was good. At the end, we were at nighttime. Our truck got stuck in the sand on the border, and just before it got stuck, our fixer said, "You know, this is a dangerous place, and we do not want to be. You don't want to be here after dark." And yes, but long story short, we were there for about an hour, and then we got questioned by the cartel. The cartel showed up. Yeah, and like these SUVs and surrounded us and asked, you know, to see our credentials. And they were like, "Who are you? This is a very dangerous place. There's, you know, lots of kidnappings happen here."
Oh, great.
yeah. So it was very frightening. We had alerted the, you know, the desk that we were stuck, and then they showed up. But, you know, it could have gone south very quickly. But we had a good fixer, and he was able to de-escalate.
Yeah.
So,
gosh.
Yeah. You know, stuff like that happens.
Yeah. So with your Ukraine stuff, did you just go out there then of your own, like, did you know people out there? Do you have a family connection to the area? Or were you just, you picked it as a place as like, the stuff's going on here, I need to get there. Like, how does that come about?
So I've been three times now. The first time I went was, I got there before the war started. The war started in February of 2022. And I arrived in December, December 2021. And I didn't know that, you know, we didn't know that there was going to be a full-scale invasion happening. I saw reports that, oh, there was some buildup of troops, but I wanted to go because I was interested in the country. You know, growing up, with the backdrop of that conflict. And then, you know, just interesting cultural stories I wanted to cover. I was supposed to be there only for 20 days. And then as the talks, as tensions were building, I ended up staying for 8-9 weeks that time, up into, you know, and then after the full scale invasion. And then, then I returned twice since then.
Wow. And a slightly kind of, I guess, off topic direction for this, because the thing I'm thinking whilst you're talking, you're fairly young, you're early in your career. How are you looking after you in all of this? Because the stuff you're experiencing is big life-changing stuff for the people experiencing it, and they're just doing the one thing. But you're going from like meeting cartels and hoping to God that your fix is good at their job to then coming back to covering some aftermath of a wildfire, which in some ways might be worse than seeing the fires, because the fires are in the moment and everyone's like just coping the best they can. But now you're looking at what people are left to deal with, which is something that's a lot heavier to sit with afterwards. Like, are you getting any, as part of the work you're doing, as part of the people you're working with, are they giving you any advice on like how to kind of have this? Because I've watched like documentaries, Don McCullen and people like that. Like, this stuff sits with people afterwards. Like, how are you feeling about that? Because this is an amazing thing you're doing, but it's a lot to take on.
Yeah, it really is. I think it does take a toll. I feel like I've been pretty fortunate, with my mental health so far. I've seen colleagues who've been doing this for decades, and it's been hard on them. I think our generation, is much better prepared. People, in their 30s and 40s and younger, there's much more of an openness to talk about mental health than some of the older photojournalists who I see, at the hotel bar drinking, et cetera. Yeah. I think mental health is super important to take care of. Longevity in this career is important. But to your point though, I think we as, people, we get to, choose when we cover a story and when we leave. And, right. For the people that we're covering, it's, they're living it day in and day out. Mm. So I feel fortunate to be able to leave. But, what we cover, it does stick with us.
Yeah.
So I think, talking about it with colleagues is, people who've covered, similar stories, I think has always been beneficial.
Yeah. It was something I really wanted to ask about you about if we got there, because I don't think that would have come up in a conversation with a photojournalist like 10 years ago, necessarily even, it wouldn't have been a thing that people considered. Like in the movies, it's always like, people swoop in and then they swoop out and then they drink in the bar afterwards. And you're like, that seems fucked. That's not a good way for them to live.
No, it's not. It does take a toll on people. I don't know. I think like with the cartel. Like, I was pretty rattled. But, you know, I was able to, you know, after talking to people, and it was, yeah, I think, you know, that's just one of the good ways is, you know, talking about it. And then, you know, finding, you know, I know a lot of photojournalists, you know, have talked to therapists and other, you know, practice mindfulness. And so, you know, there are a lot of different strategies. And so, yeah, I did a workshop, the Eddie Adams workshop, in October, and they had some workshops as well on, you know, mental health and the importance of that.
Yeah.
So, yeah. Yeah.
Good. I think that's a key thing as well to take away, because again, like, we, those of us who are tourists, which are most of the people listening to this right now who just enjoy photography, like, we don't, you know, we just see the images. We go, oh, that's so cool, and oh, what a great shot, and oh, I really got it. Like, you kind of have to kind of, you know, images flash by us as well these days that much faster now, because they were just, you know, it's in a scroll, or it's, you know, it's just flashed up on your screen as part of the TV news for a couple of seconds, and then it goes. And we don't necessarily, like, stop for a moment and go, they were people experiencing that in that moment. You know, like, that's one of the things. It's why I think photo books and things like that are so important. And you can then sit with an image for a bit longer and really think about how it came about. You know, it's kind of.
It, yeah, I mean, it really does sort of, you know, pose, you know, multiple questions about, you know, why do we take photos and the importance of photos? And, you know, is a photo worth taking? You know, is there certain risks worth taking for a photo? And, you know, it's something that I wrestle with, and, you know, I go back and forth on, you know, the answers about, you know, I don't think, it, you know, my editors, you know, have said before, you know, no photo is worth your life, which I, you know, I think is true. Absolutely. Definitely not. No photo is worth your life. I think, you know, there are definitely a camp of journalists who think that, you know, if only this one photo will change a war, or will, you know, stop a war, or do whatever. And I think, you know, I think that would be kidding yourself, because we've had, you know, amazing, you know, powerful photos, and, you know, there hasn't been change. You know, look at, you know, look at the photos coming out of Gaza, or look at, you know, Auschwitz, or look at, you know, Vietnam War, right? You know, powerful, powerful photos, and, you know, wars still happen. I think, though, that, you know, photojournalism does have the power of, you know, being able to transport a person and to see what a, you know, what is happening. Or as, you know, Ron Haviva, you know, famous photojournalist, you know, took photos from, I think it was Kosovo, and they were used for, like, a war crimes tribunal as evidence. So, you know, there is an impact that you can have, you know, but I think, as your point to, like, photo books, or, like, I don't know, print or something, being able to hold on to a photo and have something tangible to look at rather than just on your phone, where, you know, it's so easy to keep scrolling, you know, is beneficial.
I think that might be where your future career potentially as a filmmaker comes in too. Because a filmmaker, when you're experiencing something, moving images, you're not in control of it, right? Like, I was listening to something recently. They were talking about old movies from, like, the 70s and 80s, and they were talking about how much slower scenes were and the rationale they put forward was, like, the director's like, look, you're in the seat, you've gone to the cinema, like, what else are you gonna look at? You're not. I'm gonna tell this story, you know, the French Connection. I'm gonna have these scenes play out the way I want them to play out. Thanks very much. So I guess in your future part of your work, you'll have a bit more control over, like, what someone's looking at, and for the time that they're looking at, maybe a little more.
Yeah, I think, you know, video is sort of the future in terms of people's attention spans. You know, it makes me sad, though, in some ways. I wish people still looked at newspapers, but, you know, who am I kidding? I say that as, you know, someone who only occasionally flips through a paper, and, you know, that is someone who is, you know, media literate and actually, you know, looks at, you know, journalism. So, you know, the vast majority of listeners and, you know, people, I'm sure, you know, don't actually have a subscription.
I have a pile of magazines next to me of things that I've subscribed to that I don't look at enough as well. That's the other problem, you know, like, it's, yeah. I've just recently gone back to notebooks, though, like paper notebooks from using iPads and stuff. It's nice. It's fun. It's just more fun to write things down and have a nice pen. Like, it's a nice, not even a nice pen, like, just a pen just feels quite nice. And it sort of, it gives you something to kind of fiddle with, and sort of paper and tactility is nice. Have you ever made any photo books of your own stuff that aren't, like, I guess portfolios are one thing, like printed portfolios potentially, or maybe that's not even a thing anymore.
I haven't yet. You know, maybe one day a photo book would be, you know, nice, something to be able to, like, look at, at least, you know, for myself. I've made prints, for myself as well. And after seeing a photo printed versus, on the, computer, it takes on a whole new life and, can appreciate it differently. No, but even like I know a lot of people print out their portfolios, but for the work that I do, it's mostly just, it's all digital.
I guess it's just like it's the way that we it's the medium now, isn't it? It's the way that we share everything, just
But people still collect photo books. One of my editors, he's a huge pile of them, so and keeps growing. So yeah, they're not lost yet.
No, they're a great source of inspiration. Like, and I will say, from doing the podcast, I've bought so many photo books now after speaking to people and like finding old out of print. I was looking today for a Bill Cunningham photo book for he used to go around, if you know Bill's work, but he used to go around New York photographing fashion, and he did it for 50 years or something. Anna Wintour is famously quoted as saying, "We all dress for Bill." Well, that was a thing, and there's a couple of documentaries about him. He's really, really good. I'm going to write about him, I think, in a couple of weeks for the newsletter. But there's a sequence in one of the documentaries I watched about him where he's at Paris Photo, no, New York Fashion Week, and his uniform was always like a French worker's blue jacket, like a really simple over jacket, and he cycled everywhere. And he's by this point he's comfortably in his 70s, I think, and he's just trying to walk in to like where there's going to be some runway show, and the security guard like stops him because he thinks he's just some old dude with a camera, and this person comes running out and sort of takes him by the arm to bring him in and looks very pointedly at the security guard and goes, "You do not know how important this man is," and just walks him in. And I feel like that's the power of photography as well. It's like to be there, you're documenting, you're capturing stuff, things won't be forgotten. Like he was capturing celebrities and stuff like that, which is always going to be an audience for. But I guarantee he'll have captured thousands of people as well who weren't famous. They were just on the street, and that was the fashion of the time and stuff. It's, you're there to kind of witness, I guess, time
Interesting.
passing and people. So yeah, but yeah, Bill Cunningham was great. Seemed like a lovely
Oh, I'll
human.
look at that. Yeah.
Yeah, he lived in New York seemingly his entire life and just photographed every day, and very begrudgingly moved away from film when his editors eventually complained to him and were like, "We need, because he would go down to the developing place and like complain, like look at his contact sheets and then complain that they weren't developing his film fast enough for him." Very exacting. What does the rest of the day hold for you then? So you're kind of getting ready to go out and see, you're just out all afternoon shooting. Is that the plan?
Yeah, I'm working, working on this documentary, so filming, doing some footage of the destruction. I think there's so much of it, it's hard to sort of capture the scale, so gonna be doing this for a few days. So just went to a film rental house to go pick up a slider to get some, movement in the footage.
I've seen a lot of drone footage, but it weirdly, there's so much has been damaged and so much is gone. It almost looks fake because it's so flat and just there's just remains. It doesn't feel real somehow. So maybe being on the ground will like help it kind of.
Yeah, I mean, I think you need the aerial perspective, but even on the ground, there's just so much. It's hard to encapsulate into one image because one photo doesn't do it justice. One burnt home or two or three doesn't show the scale, and so it's just hard to visualize that and contextualize it for an audience. Yeah, especially who aren't from LA.
And are you connected with or working with any of the kind of people like funds collecting and charities and stuff like that? Have you been talking to any of them, or because there's lots of them now, aren't there? Like collecting stuff, like trying to help families who've been displaced.
No, I mean, I know there are like lots and lots of like GoFundMes and other organizations helping. I haven't been connected with any. I know I've seen like my photos being floated around as part of donations, like on donation pages. But no, my work has basically just been with the Associated Press, and now with this documentary. And so I've just, nose to the grindstone, sort of.
Will the documentary be, is it part of your college stuff, or is this just a personal project that you're going to put out?
No, it's part of a production company in Austria reached out, and so I think they're working on it. I think it'll be released next year.
Austria is a long way away to be covering LA and covering the fires.
Yeah, well, I think it's part of a project they had been working on, and now this is now part of it. So they want to, it's a larger project. Yeah.
That's really, really cool. Well, thank you so much for like taking some time out of your day and like just stopping by the side of the road. I have to say, recording from cars is actually double plus good on the sound quality. Like it's really great. It's worked really well.
Excellent. Yeah, I've recorded stuff in a car before, you know, with like a sound blanket overhead, and it, you know, the insulation helps. But sorry, I was worried about the car traffic being an issue, so I hope it wasn't too bad.
No, it's good. I think the thing, I mean, it's a great thing from the pandemic in a way, that if I'd tried to start something like this a few years ago, it would have been, we'd have had to have met in person. There would have been had to have been perfect microphones. It would have had to, like, but the good thing about once Hugh Jackman was on TV using his iMac to record an interview on like Conan or something, like all bets were off, you know, like it's just, and so I think it's more real in a lot of ways. Like actually, it's funny how the conversations I have within 5 minutes tell me what they're going to be. So like I can kind of like with questions and things kind of steer it a certain way and guide it a certain way. The fact that you're in the field is about as perfect on reflection. You know, like you want to talk to someone who's a working photojournalist who goes out and tells stories. To some extent, it would have been felt more phony somehow if you'd been at a desk with a perfect kind of YouTube streamer light. But the fact that you're in your car and you're like, yeah, I've picked up some gear and I'm kind of, and then I'm going to go off and shoot some B-roll and do whatever. And it's fantastic. It's perfect.
Very good. Yeah, I think it's also like the quality of these, the phones and with the Zoom. Well, this isn't Zoom, but like has been excellent. In fact, it was so good over Christmas. We were trying to do something where someone was going to play an instrument, and the Zoom had isolated the voice so well that we actually couldn't hear the person playing the instrument. So, you know, AI is powerful, but you know, you can't use AI for photojournalism.
No, definitely not. That's got to be happening in person. Well, for people listening who don't know your stuff, and obviously there'll be a link in the show notes, but where can they find you and follow your work and kind of keep up with everything, Ethan?
Yeah, I'm active on Instagram at Ethan Swope Photo, you know, website Ethan Swope Photo, and then, you know, on the wires. So if you search my name, you know, they'll appear there. But I really appreciate you reaching out and, you know, being able to talk, you know, and so thank you.
Cool. I will say it's great as well to talk to someone who's like, sorry, I need to move our catch up because I have to go and like photograph the Mexican-US border and potentially cartel. And so that's pretty cool. Like that's made my, by extension, that's made my week cooler, you know?
well, I was happy to be able to make it work.
Yeah. Oh, it's awesome. Well, have a much more relaxing afternoon, my friend.
Thank you very much. Alrighty. All right.
Take care.
Have a good one. Take care.
See you soon.
Bye.
Bye. Thanks again to Ethan there for taking the time, and I look forward to seeing the film when it comes out. If you enjoyed this episode, don't forget that you can like and subscribe to the podcast wherever you get your podcasts. That's Apple Podcasts, Spotify, Amazon Music, YouTube Music, all the musics. Tell a friend, leave a review. That really helps other people to find the show. You can also subscribe to the Midweek newsletter. That goes out every Wednesday, and that's available on ianfarrell.com/sign-up, and there is a link to it in the show notes and on social media. Right, I think that'll probably do for this week. Thanks very much for listening, and we'll see you next time.